Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a December 27, 2008 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us today is a very special guest, an environmental sociologist by the name of Mark D. Whitaker. And Mark, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program. Now, you're joining us from Seoul, South Korea, is that correct?
Yes, I'm in Seoul, South Korea. You're cutting in and out. I can hope that will be corrected soon.
Yeah, you were tuning out. You're sounding better now.
Okay, that's good.
So how did you come to be in Korea?
I came to be in Korea because a lot of my sociological interest was dealing with long-term patterns of environmental problems and the interactions of states change, environmental change, political economic change, and a lot of the cases that I analyzed. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the cases that I analyzed were in East Asia, and they offered me a job, and so here I am.
Very good. So you're working for the government, or?
No, I'm working for a private university.
I see. Okay. Now, exactly what has been your career path then?
I'm getting a strange echo back. Is that normal? Okay.
I think everything's okay. Yeah, we may both of us feel a little bit disconcerted about the quality of sound, but I think it's all right.
Okay, now, I'll concentrate, but I'm getting a repeat of my voice back at a delay of about 15 seconds. But yes, I'm working at a private university. My career path, I am a practicing sociologist.
Okay. How many environmental sociologists are there in the world?
Probably enough to fit in a very small room. Now, there's maybe 25 or so, I think, positions within the U.S. I knew only six positions came open last year, and this was actually a dream job because, as I said, some of my long-term interests are in East Asia and long-term environmental problems. But I also compared them to – hello?
Yes. Okay. Everything's fine. Just keep talking.
Okay. Anyway, that's just the point. I was interested in comparing China, Japan, and Europe for long-term patterns of environmental problems, and this actually turned into a job offer within East Asia because of my substantive research background. But my main interest is in sustainability and unsustainability. Okay.
And that's what brings you to this program. I noticed as I was doing some general research on Amazon.com, which happens to be a very good place to find out what's out there in terms of information, because just about anything worth knowing has also been published in a book. So you can sort of do a little bit of searching on Amazon.com, and sometimes things will just pop up on the screen that you didn't even look for. And your book was one of those things.
Well, thanks. Yeah, actually, it is a new area of research. I mean to start a debate about a different view towards sustainability. Most views of sustainability argue that there are issues of population or a new managerial economic is required or simply new technology. I argue that a lot of the things about sustainability already exist in the real world, and they're not being applied, and I think we should look towards political corruption as a major problem in achieving sustainability. So I began to think about what would be formal democratic institutional adaptations for sustainability, which would allow for greater use of more sustainable technologies and materials that we already have available.
Yeah, and that's what I think caused me to invite you to be a guest on this program, because you're one of the few voices of reason in recognizing what the obstacles are to implementing, for instance, advanced alternative energy technology that's been with us for decades.
Right. Particularly the name of your show being the water car arrangement. This technology has been invented several times over the past. Yeah.
So you are aware of that?
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that was going to be one of my questions to you is, you don't specifically mention alternative energy technologies in the description of your book online. I don't have a copy of it yet, so I, I can't comment on what's inside it, but do you actually cover any alternative energy technologies that have been suppressed or
Port of Bioregional State is a book which exclusively deals with formal institutional structures. I'm planning a second book in this series, which would deal with technologies that are available, which would also deal with ideas for how to adapt scientific institutions, which I think we have an institutionalized ignorance framework, which doesn't allow us to understand the interactions between the social, the biological, and the physical very well. We have three different career tracks. So you have, you know, biologists learning a lot about cells, but not really of the dynamics or problems of how social change develops certain kinds of biological changes, as well as just the importance of knowing about the interactions, I think, are far more important than the three different career tracks that we've developed mostly within the Western Academy so far. So the Bioregional State is, you've seen, is the first book dealing with formal institutional changes in the state. And the second book will be dealing with the sciences, consumption, and technologies, as well as finance.
Yeah. Well, I think that the message that's presented in the description of your book, which, by the way, is available at Amazon.com, and again, the title of the book is Toward a Bioregional State.
Yes. If I may mention, there are two additional websites that people could view sections of it for free, as well as my personal descriptions. This is at biostateblogspot.com, or dealing with different forms of technologies and materials. This is at commodityecologyblogspot.com. And that has a list of 86 different material categories.
Wow. So the title of the book is rather long. It's Toward a Bioregional State, a series of letters about political theory and formal institutional design in the era of sustainability.
That's
I don't
correct.
Know of any book with a longer title.
Yes, it is sort of a throwback to the 16th century, I know. Because I am trying to contribute to a form of enlightenment democratic theory. And I also wanted to put major important searchable terms within the title itself.
Well, you accomplished that.
Any
number of searches would bring it up. Perhaps that's how it came up on my Amazon search.
Well, good. That's sort of intentionally why it was named this way, but it was also a tongue-in-cheek issue because, as I said, this goes back to the Enlightenment era when people began to think about, what if we don't want royal estates? What if we don't want to be ruled by aristocratic structures? What formal institutions would oppose tyranny? And I argue that this book is a continuation of how we oppose tyranny. And our new tyrannies, I think, are on the level of ecological tyranny.
Yes. Well, in particular, you make use of the word gatekeepers.
Yes.
And that with regard to the institutions that are supposedly in place to protect the environment and to implement, for instance, superior energy technologies and so on.
Yes.
I think that's what you're referring to when you say that these gatekeepers end up being the main ones who are hindering progress.
Yes. I argue that at the very beginning of the book, the dynamics of the way we've legitimated the state, we've ignored a great deal of problems in trying to pretend that nothing is wrong or that our democracies are truly functioning. I argue that a lot of the problems of political corruption within the human world have environmentally degradative effects in the, you know, in the ecological world, and of course in our human health problems as well.
Yeah, you make the statement here in this description of your, well, it's actually a description of a conference you attended in South Africa 2 years ago.
Yes.
But it says, this is a novel approach to development and to sustainability. It says he proposes, he being you, that instead of sustainability being an issue of population scale, managerial economics, or technocratic planning, an overhaul of formal democratic institutions is required. This is because environmental degradation has more to do with the biased interactions of formal institutions and informal corruption. Because of corruption, we have environmental degradation.
Yes. Yeah.
So in doing some reading at the Amazon page of your book, it mentioned that ascertain that the public is in favor of more stringent, watchfulness or preservation of the environment than what the political institutions are giving. That the implication is that the public doesn't care, but apparently you've found that the public does care. It's just that the government isn't mirroring that concern. Is that correct?
Yep, that is correct. Actually, if you look at the blog, biostateblogspot.com, there are four-part series of polls that I have posted over the past half year, which demonstrate huge supermajorities of 75 to 80% support for, in the United States as well as other countries, for hard environmentalism. So I would argue this is a gatekeeping structure. We have structures of states that don't reflect democracy, but which channel it into certain forms and ignore a great other forms. And my point is to argue if we structured the formal institutions slightly differently, we would have a much more competitive democracy, which would be good on the human level as well as the environmental level, because they were interconnected.
So the corruption that you refer to that causes the institutions to not respond appropriately to the needs and the wishes of the public when it comes to saving the environment, for instance, so that we have clean air to breathe and a decent water, oceans that are healthy, and so on. I don't see it directly, implicated here, but we're basically talking about the corporate world and their lobbyists influencing.
Well, I would say it's the interaction between the corporate and the existing party structures, which aren't truly openly representative, as well as dealing with the elected people themselves. And the dynamics of how electors are chosen, I think, should be adapted slightly as well. One of the more charismatic ideas in the book, which helps understand what the main aim of the book is if we could have districts of states which were organized on watersheds, instead of organized on returning incumbents into power. This, I would argue, allows a more ecological self-interest of peoples, which I would argue exists as part of the human condition.
So you're saying that water is such an important commodity, and it's so threatened right now.
The existing structure of state.
I'm sorry?
This would allow that ecological self-interest to move towards state politics on a more durable basis.
So you're emphasizing the importance of water and how scarce it's becoming.
No, I'm emphasizing that durable districts is one example of 60 in the book that would allow a more stable way of expressing an ecological self-interest of local peoples against unsustainable external development.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was noticing an article that came out in a magazine recently that talked about how water is becoming more scarce on the surface of this planet, that is usable, drinkable water, and how large bodies of water have been shrinking. Of course, the Aral Sea is a primary example. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Uh-huh.
But I think Lake Chad is another example that was given.
There's very small amounts of... Hello?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'm hearing an echo of my voice and your previous question, so I apologize if this is slightly confusing.
I don't think that listeners are hearing that, though.
I know, but that's why I hear your voice and I respond to the wrong question again.
Okay, so I think we're okay now. Can you proceed?
Yes. Water is becoming more scarce, but I would argue that we have plenty of technical solutions which could be developed to avoid this. So it's a rather optimistic view, and my point is everything for sustainability is already been achieved. It's just not being applied. If you'll browse the categories, the 86 different commodity categories at commodityecologyblogspot.com, I think you'll see what I mean, that there are many ways to achieve potable water as well as to clear it, which could blend energy production and other frameworks. So I'm not stressing the fact that a scarcity issue. I'm stressing the fact that it can be solved right now instead of being caught up, I suppose, on the presumed ideas of scarcity.
Yeah, which is because very encouraging that you have a very positive outlook on the possibility of a large world population achieving complete sustainability. It's just a matter of throwing the bums out, I guess, is what you're saying, huh?
Yeah, it's an organizational. It's not necessarily a population issue. If anybody would like to read the best rebuttal of populationism, you should read the book by Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen. It's called Poverty and Famines. It was published well over 25 years ago, and it's an excellent case-by-case discussion of how famines don't really come about through overpopulation, but through lack of entitlements of peoples, political entitlements to food, or political entitlements to the state protecting them. And he found that places of the world that had a greater chance of democratization don't have famines, but places with less representative forms of government tend to have repeated famines.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just one. I don't want to get caught up in what's called Malthusianism, but most people interpret environmental problems as a Malthusian issue, as dealing with one variable, abstract variable called population. Of course, the dynamic... Hello?
Yes.
Okay. And most people don't understand the issue of distribution and how distributional inequalities are causing a lot more problems, and political development, political pressure development is causing a lot of developmental problems instead of necessarily population per se. For instance, very, very wealthy areas of the world are out-consuming and connecting to environmental problems at a much greater degree than the massive amount of people in the world sufficing on less than $1 a day.
So we're both pigs and slobs, you're saying. Is that it?
Well, my point is it doesn't really matter. I mean, that's the debate. That's the way that Malthusianism is easily critiqued. My point is, if you want to move toward a sustainable society, it's very possible because, one, all the technologies and materials are quite available. Two, we need to find ways of implementing them. And one of the reasons implementation has been difficult is political corruption built into previous material structures. That's what I call the raw material regime phenomenon. It's a form of crony materials in a particular position which protect themselves through law, through discourses in the public media, from any kind of change or any kind of critique. Like, you know, we have 50 choices of gasoline without a choice of what kind of energy runs in our cars for most people in the world. That's not really a choice. Right now, there are developments of water-based cars and air-based cars, which are being mass manufactured as of last year. Tata Motors in India are mass manufacturing air-based cars. And water-based cars may be getting off the road, mass-produced, dealing with some things that I've seen in Japan recently. But, of course, many people have invented these before, and the problem has been political corruption in stopping these, I argue. And it's a dual development that I expect to see, one coming from people like you who are more interested in the material sides, but also people organizing on the local level with others and developing political structures which are more representative of local ecological self-interest at the same time.
Yeah, well, wouldn't it be good if more college curriculums included your particular course of study?
I'm sorry, would it be better if they did? Of course,
I mean,
it would be better.
Yeah, what can be done so that more young people are studying this very topic that we're discussing?
Well, I think it would be useful if people approach commodities as a political issue and not as an economic issue. To help this, at Amazon.com, I've organized about 11 different pages listing what I euphemistically call commodity biographies. And commodity biographies are really just histories of commodities. Instead of analyzing them as some abstract of just supply and demand and, you know, scale of investment, I look at their particular histories in competition with other choices. And I think the best way to understand how politicized our consumption structure is and how protected the politics of a certain consumption structure is to just pick up a good book about the history of oil. Edwin Black wrote a really good book about the internal combustion engine and published it 2 years ago.
This book
was called Internal Combustion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what my point is. He basically demonstrates that the problem was not oil, but the problem was this political regime protecting oil and denying far more sustainable challengers. So I would say to those who feel that, well, the important thing to do is only to work on, you know, new technologies, we have to perfect them and get them, I definitely support that. My point is, to be a good ally, I would tell those people that the best thing to do would be to organize better political structures to protect your intellectual and definitely selfless investments in time and effort to help the world be a better place.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily believe that that's going to happen, but I wanted to have you as a guest on this program to emphasize that that is the major obstacle. It is not the lack of the technology or the lack of people interested in promoting the technology. It's the structure of society as we know it that has to change.
Mm-hmm. And I argue in the book there are at least 60 different additional ecological checks and balances that I would add using the U.S. Constitution as a basis to move out, not removing a thing, unlike many people who would like to remove things from the U.S. Constitution. I would like to expand our freedoms to address certain forms of ecological tyranny which have been left unaddressed in the past.
Can you give an example of that?
I mentioned the watershed districts is one way of removing district drawing for elections from informal parties. Most countries have very little laws against a gerrymandered district. Increasingly, in the United States, for instance, there were laws only from the 1960s promoting one person, one vote within a district. So there were radically twisted kinds of districts where very populated districts of people with little representation and very low-level populations with exactly the same number of representational power within the state. And one change in the 1960s, mostly due to the Black Civil Rights Movement, was the one-person, one-vote requirements for districts, as well as to remove gerrymandered districts, which are long tendrils of irregular shapes, which try to group together certain people of the same ideological bent. I argue if you had stable districts, for instance, which were more ecologically sound and based on natural boundaries, that the people would increasingly realize that green issues and ecological issues are not an ideological issue. This is an issue which people on the right, as well as people on the left and in between, all have in common.
Because
in
it's
the
their backyard.
Area their, yeah, it is their backyard. And there are two polls that I mentioned on my website, biostateblogspot.com. I'll just summarize the point of them. Both of them show that even in the United States, around 75 to 80% of the U.S. population, with little regard for whether the people consider themselves leftists or rightists, they all want their environmental laws not only protected but strengthened. In other words, people in politics talk about a wedge issue, and a wedge issue is something which splits groups. Ironically, green politics is something which is bringing people together on the local level, but both parties on the national level of many states worldwide refuse to touch these issues because they realize basically this is a dawning huge movement, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult to stop or channel into the existing gatekeeping frameworks of parties. So I wrote this book with the dynamic that it would be sort of a fig leaf or a peace leaf which could be handed to existing elites to show them there are better ways to change than increasingly repressing structures of sustainability which are trying to bubble up from below.
Right. Now, when you speak of trying to bubble up from below, is it possible to create a dumbed-down version of your book for that more grassroots level of understanding or
Yeah, that's why I post... I've posted... The book is written at a very high level because it really is a contribution to constitutional engineering, green constitutional engineering. The website where I comment on various news stories, I think, is an excellent window to get a picture of what the bioregional state implies and its dynamic of an ecological contract. Instead
I guess
of
what I'm thinking of is something more like a YouTube video of a soundbite length that can somehow infuse some understanding, some immediate understanding, or, you know, getting blue-collar workers to grasp your message in such a simple format that they would then run with it, you know.
Well, one thing I would suggest is that what could be done anywhere, I agree. People have suggested that to me before, so I think I should do that. But I would stress that it doesn't require any particular leadership forms. There are two institutions that I would recommend any watershed have, and these could be self-organizing for sustainability and optimization for a local area. One would be a civic democratic institution, which is not really connected to the government at all. It's just a recognition body of people who are already admired and a way of sort of decoupling culture of our large states from the party structure. And so if people on the local level had an organization where they could voice their problems outside of appealing to left or right, I think that would be very beneficial. I describe certain ways that would remove problems about voting, I think, which are endemic to most structures of states now. And the other institution is called Commodity Ecology, which is, you know, an open meeting, which happens maybe twice a year amongst 86 different commodity producers in the local area. And they would get together and they'd say, I have this trash, you know, I want to do something with it besides throwing it away. Who wants to use it? Or citizens or consumers could come to them and say, I want you to build a water car. I can guarantee you that you will have a huge market together. So the arrangements can be created beforehand instead of depending only on the market mechanism. Sort of a grassroots command economy, I guess. Somebody else has told me that's sort of a way of understanding it.
Hello? Very good. Well,
okay.
We've come to the end of a half hour,
okay.
And I'm sure we could continue talking for another half hour. What would you like to say in conclusion to our listeners that would give them an idea of what you expect to see happening in the near future, perhaps?
Well, I would say we have one of two choices. One, we continue with the gray form of political economy we have, and nothing much changes. But if you are interested in change, I suggest the best place to start would be to look at my two websites. One is called biostateblogspot.com, biostate.blogspot.com, and the other one is Commodity Ecology, commodity, ecology, ecology.blogspot.com. And these set out, I think, in a more simple fashion with images and examples of how we could move forward to a sustainable society on the long term, as well as for incremental change on the short term.
And
in
just
summary,
one more question.
Sorry.
Do you see any more promising response in Korea, for instance, than you saw as you were here in the States?
Korea, simply by geographic issues, does not have large raw material regimes around oil, coal, or gas. So their political structure is far more open, I think, to understanding the political power that materials have. So they're lucky to not have that problem of a built-in coal economy like the U.S. has, or like China has a built-in coal economy. Japan is also in a similar situation. It's always been very resource and material poor, which has allowed it, and probably one of the reasons why the Japanese government funds coal fusion research, whereas the U.S. government has basically killed that dynamic. So I think, at least among the students and professors that I've shared my ideas with, there is quite a lot of interest when people begin to think about environmentalism from the level of something we all share, and that is the formal state. Regardless of political ideology, participation in democracy, and enhancing democracy, I think, is a winning way to think about environmentalism.
Well, I thank you so much for... I'm sorry?
No, and that's basically my idea. A greater and more perfected democracy would be a more sustainable society, and that one of the reasons we have such an unsustainable society is that our democracies are very incomplete.
Flawed. Yeah, well, I really appreciate your taking the time. I know you're in the middle of the night there. So
yes.
We appreciate the effort you put forth to be a guest on this program, and I'm sure your message has struck home with many of our listeners.
Okay, I appreciate all your help in arranging this, James.
All right, you take care, and I wish everyone a good evening.
All right, thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
And good morning or good afternoon to you. Bye-bye.